All right. Hi, everyone. It's good to see you all. This is Dr. Will Tuttle. It's Thursday, February 15th, and we are embarking on our third Thursday World Peace Diet Circle call. I want to thank all of you for joining. There's lots of things happening. Madeline and I have had a really busy time lately, and we're leaving tomorrow, right after lunch for Miami, after being here at Hippocrates Wellness Institute in West Palm Beach for 2 months. We've been here actually for 2 months. So, we enjoy our time here, but like the old saying says, anything that has a beginning has an end. And we are delighted to actually have an event tomorrow night in Miami at this fantastic place called Aguacate, which is Spanish for avocado. So it's Aguacate or Avocado Sanctuary of Love. It's a restaurant, mostly outdoor kind of a restaurant, with all vegan food that's really well prepared. And they have a lot of animals there too. So they've got like a good couple of acres of land somehow by a miracle in Miami. And they have some chickens and ducks and geese and pigs and sheep and goats and I think one or two cows even. So it's a great place to bring children. There's lots of children there, lots of families, lots of people going vegan. Yeah, really great kind of a place, lots of classes. So we'll be giving a workshop there tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock, and we have some friends coming down from Hippocrates to join that. And then we're heading on from there down to Key West, and we're doing 4 events in Key West, which I think is also kind of exciting. On Saturday we have a lecture promoting vegan living on the World Peace Diet, and then we have a workshop on intuition and a concert and a Sunday morning service at Unity. So anyway, and then we're going to be continuing on up to Fort Myers, and I won't go into all the details, but we're booking quite a few events in Florida and then across through Louisiana and Texas and Arizona and Southern California. We're looking forward, actually, Gino, to returning to San Diego. We still have to find out, and Andy, find out about that, if we can do something again at that restaurant that was so great in San Diego. I can't remember the name of it, but it was that great.
Village.
They're still carrying on there, as I understand it. There's apparently quite a few debts they're trying to pay off.
But yeah, they've been doing fundraisers, and those are going pretty well, but they still have a long way to go.
Right. I guess it's just difficult with the rent being so high and all those different things. So we love them. They're great people. And, we hope we can support them, or we can, do something there. So, yeah, so I'm just getting things ready. Welcome, Lisa, making you the co-host here. You can help out. All right, so it's good to see you all. We're usually what we like to do is have the meditation pretty early on. And so let's go ahead and join together for that, and then we can open it up for discussion. So I will, I don't have the piano, so I'll just do it right here, where we are in our, for the last night in our beloved little room they gave us at Hippocrates. And, it's probably good. Feel free to leave, your camera. I mean, it's best to have the microphones probably muted. Your cameras you can have either way. Sometimes it's better to turn them off if you're meditating, but either way. All right, so here we go. Let's just take a moment and have our circle, our World Peace Diet circle of consciousness connect with the purpose of our life in this incarnation, connect with the deeper reason that we're here, whatever that is for us, in our own way, and give thanks for this precious opportunity that we have of a human birth and this opportunity to serve, this opportunity to learn and grow to contribute and to help be a force for healing and awakening, and to deepen our connection with the inner wisdom that guides us in our life, in all our lives, and to connect more deeply with our mandated purpose, the purpose we have chosen, and with the infinite power of consciousness that's always available to us for healing and insight, for love and kindness, for helping to co-create a world where peace and freedom and justice are actually possible. So let's give thanks for this precious opportunity that we have to be on this call, and give thanks for each and every one of us that are joined on this call here this evening. It's really an honor to be able to share precious time together, especially when we have so many obligations and requirements. So thank you all for taking time out of your busy schedules to be here. Welcome. Welcome home. There's something really valuable, and I'd love to take a moment maybe just to savor the sense of value in sharing a space of love and awareness with people who are committed to helping to liberate animals from slavery and abuse, and helping to liberate humanity from the whole deception of animal agriculture, of killing animals for food and for other products and uses. So it's just really fantastic to be able to share the same psychic and mental and emotional and spiritual space together, knowing that as we come together like this, we multiply our efforts by a square root, by a square. So if there's 20 of us, it's 20 squared, which is, I think, whatever that is, 400. So, or 4,000 maybe. Let's see, 20, yeah, 4,000. So we have this fantastic ability and opportunity. And let's also now take time to just deepen our connection with our underlying awareness of the oneness of all life. Yeah, and it's 400, by the way. And give thanks for each and every one of us who are here. Give thanks for all the animals that are with us on this beautiful earth. We share the same air and the same water and the same land. Not only the animals who are suffering at human hands, all the free living animals as well, and all of our companion animals, and just the whole realm of animals, and the whole realm of plants. And now I understand there's a third realm, the whole realm of fungi, kind of in between. Giving thanks for all these miraculous life forms and all the intelligence that's here and that's within us, to open up to the healing power of this life that we're here to share with others. And let's give thanks knowing that every day that passes, the liberation of animals is getting closer. And every day that passes, we can celebrate in the morning knowing that the liberation of animals and human beings is one day closer. That every day is an opportunity to plant a seed to help in that grand project of liberation and reconnection with the divine love that is source of our life, that's guiding us at every moment, the inner wisdom that's always shining. And then finally, let's just together breathe and feel the healing light that shines at the very heart of the universe, just pouring right now down to the top of our head and filling every cell of our being with light, with the healing light that brings harmony and peace to all the systems in our physical body, that brings strength to our heart and our digestive system, our circulatory system, our immune system, our nervous system, all of those things, and also into all of our affairs, everything we're up to, all of our relationships, bringing harmony and joy and freedom and fulfillment and abundance, every aspect of our lives for the benefit not only of ourselves and our loved ones, but through us as a blessing to all living beings. We are here to bless the world, to bring our light. And so we allow this light to radiate from our eyes and ears and our mouth and our hands and every cell of our being through all of our actions, so that we're sending love and kindness and respect to all living beings through our gestures and through our the tone of our voice and through our the way we walk and talk and move, the way we type away on our emails, all these things that we send into the infinite web of relations, the field of kindness, love, and awareness of the unity of all life. After the few decades that we're here, we are marshaling our resources and focusing them to the highest good of all, through our attention and through our intention. Breathing together, we give thanks and allow this light now to radiate from our heart as love in all directions like an ever-expanding sphere of light. We send this love to all living beings. May all beings be happy and have all the causes of happiness, especially the animals, especially humans who are maybe in war zones or who are hungry, whose feet are close to the great change that we refer to as death, those who are having difficulties mentally or emotionally, sending especially our love and support and benediction to all animals and all the human beings and all living beings, all expressions of life, radiating love in all dimensions, especially to those who may be difficult for us. We send them our love and appreciation, breathing and radiating love, breathing and radiating compassion and empathy. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May we awaken to the power of action to help relieve the suffering of others, the wisdom to know how to do that effectively. So with every exhalation now, we're just radiating compassion into the infinite web of relation to all living beings. Great compassion, Maha Karuna, the great loving kindness, Maha Maitri, breathing and radiating love and compassion. And that brings us to the third power that's always dwelling in our consciousness, the third aspect of our true home, which is joy. The joy that flows naturally and easily and fills our consciousness when we're in this present moment, this holy moment right now. So with every exhalation, let's radiate joy, the light of joy, in all directions to all living beings. May all beings remember the underlying joy of being and liberate others and be liberated in that understanding that our true nature is joy, that life essentially is a tremendous blessing And we allow that understanding to radiate through our entire culture, to bring healing to our society, to all the institutions, so that they're lined up with the truth of joy and freedom, loving kindness and compassion, abiding in the true home of love, compassion, and joy. And finally, we allow the light of consciousness to radiate from our heart as peace in all directions, breathing and radiating peace, the great peace that is inherent when our mind and heart is filled with the love, compassion, and joy that are our true nature, and we are at peace. A great peace that fills every dimension of space. All the apparent outer conflicts that are arising in many ways are dreamlike. And the reality is harmony and peace. So we abide now in the reality of our true nature, of our unity with the infinite love that is the source of all life, breathing and radiating peace into all dimensions and all directions, to all living beings. And we see the whole earth as a light and a beautiful illuminated jewel of harmony and peace. We just allow the prisons to empty, the factory farms, slaughterhouses, and stockyards to all empty, the war zones and munitions factories to all empty, the insane asylums and hospitals to all empty, all the schools, governmental buildings, they all empty. It's all empty. It's the awareness of the oneness of all life, remaking our relations with each other and with animals and with all beings. So we abide in this, knowing this is the inescapable triumph of consciousness and love. And we are grateful for all the lessons that we are learning in this incarnation to help contribute to the realization of the truth that unites all of us, all living beings. So now we allow ourselves to rest for a moment in this silent awareness together, just breathing in silence. We give thanks for this silence beyond conditioning and separation, beyond the sense of myself as a separate self. Ah, wonderful. Okay, so let's come back together in our shared space. Thank you again, everyone, for joining in our World Peace Circle. And I have no big agenda for today, so I'm happy to address any pressing issues that anybody may have, or any questions or curiosities or challenges or celebrations or victories or agonies or whatever it is. And feel free to press star 6 on your phone, if you're on a phone, or if you go down, let's see, at the bottom here, it's called something. Whatever it is. What is it? It's reactions. Yeah, on reactions you can raise your hand, or just raise your hand. All right. So I see Susan has figured it out faster than I did. So go ahead, Susan. Be happy to respond to your whatever you'd like to say. Make sure you're unmuted. I think you are unmuted. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, everybody. I will. Thank you. I was a VA social worker. I was the visual impairment services social worker, so I dealt with a lot of legally blind veterans and their families. Anyway, you know, I know that you cured yourself of legal blindness. And like I said to you, that, you know, I mean, as we do the meditation and we relax, I know that people can relax their eyes at the same time. But I've never had the opportunity to have you zero in on that topic, except for the fact that you've said, you know, when you took off on your pilgrimage with your brother, in a to let go of your eyeglasses, and you lived blurry for a while. But then you said you did a lot of other things too to help get your sight to perfection. So can you say any more about it for someone that I just met that I feel sorry for, you know, that he's going to lose his sight?
Right. Yeah, okay. Well, that's a really interesting topic. And I think it's important. You know, we have these five senses that we use to really, they're so important, you know, to interact. If we lose one of them, if we lose our sight, or if it gets blurry in various ways, it's really a challenge. It's a disability, you know, and same thing with hearing, same thing really with smell and taste, and of course our ability to feel, to touch. These are the five ways that we know anything is out there, if there is anything out there. And so one of the things I realized, I think I started to realize it when I was younger, is that the system, the medical system, and you've heard me say this a million times, really in many ways is a racket in the sense that it thrives on sick people, not on healthy people. There's this underlying payback. It doesn't mean that the doctors are not wonderful, loving people doing the best they can to help people. It's just that the bigger system thrives on procedures, pharmaceuticals, and sort of trying to get a chronic condition. You know, chronic conditions are like the best thing ever. You know, you get a chronic condition, you've got a customer for life. So vision is an interesting thing. And I studied it a lot because that was my main disability. I had a pretty serious disability actually with my vision, and it wasn't natural. I wasn't born with it. I was born with great eyes, and so for me, I think it's probably true for a lot of people. I think it was partly psychological. It happened when I was, I think, in sixth, seventh grade, right around there when I started, as a little boy, I was very happy and loved reaching out, and I had a great family, I think, in many ways. I was raised in the sense that they loved to be in nature. My parents they didn't fight. They were, it was, a lot of love and a lot of freedom. My father just said, do whatever you want, you know, go as far as you want. There was no fear. There was no seat belts. There was no helmets. There was no locked doors to the house. I could go down to the 5 and 10 store, which was like a mile away, and walk there when I was 6 years old and come back and, you know, walk along the highway. I mean, whatever. You know, like, it was a small town and it was friendly. But when I was 6 or 7 years old, when I was in 6th or 7th grade, I guess that's what it's at. That's like, I don't know, 11 or 12, 13. In my early teen years, I started to develop, I guess, a little tiny blur. I mean, it was so tiny. I mean, I was like, you know, every year we would go to and have our vision tested. And one time, it's not perfect. You don't have exactly perfect vision. You know, and so then they called my mother in and me, and we had an appointment, and they explained to you know that I should go to an eye doctor and get glasses because it could be detrimental to my studies. And so this story, I think, just plays out a lot. And so my mother said, oh yeah, no problem, okay, we'll go. And my mother did wear glasses. My father never did. But my mother did, so she was kind of used to it. And then, in fact, she eventually wore contact lenses. So I got these glasses, and they were very, very weak, and I didn't need them. I never needed them, so I just put them in my pocket. I thought in case for something. And I went for quite a few years with my glasses just in my pocket. But it was like the time went on. They started falling out of my pocket all the time. So I thought, well, I'll just put them on. It's easier, you know. That was a big mistake. And because what I've realized is that, you know, the body wants to heal. And so what makes a blur is when the muscles around the eye, and there's four muscles around each eye, or six. There's six muscles around each eye. There's muscles that on the top and the bottom. There's muscles on the side, the four cardinal directions of a compass. And then there's two other muscles that are kind of oblique. And so those six muscles are what causes the eye to focus and to move, you know, in and out and focus on things. So when you get a blur, it's like the muscles go into kind of a chronic spasm and they tighten up so that the light, when it comes in through the lens, is not focusing right in the pinpoint of the retina. It's called the fovea centralis. And it doesn't focus right on the fovea centralis. It focuses a little bit behind it, and so you get this blur. So the natural tendency of the brain is trying to figure things out, and it wants to relax the muscles, and you'll see clearly again. And that's what would happen in most cases. But once you put a lens in front of the eye, then it corrects your vision. You can see perfectly. But now, if the eye ever relaxes, if the muscles relax, if the natural healing tries to take place, you get a blur. That's like terrible. So now it's a chronic condition. I mean, now the eye learns to just chronically spasm so it can see clearly. And then what that does is, as the years go by, it gets more and more tight. It has to like hold on. And so I would go in every year or two, and then the eye doctor would say, "Oh yeah, I need to change your prescription. No problem." You know, so he would change it. You know, every year he would change it, which meant actually make it worse, make it stronger. And so that went all the way through until I was through high school, and he kept making it worse. And so by the time I was in college, and then I got contact lenses, and they were on all the time. You know, it was when the soft contact lenses had just come out. This was in the early 1970s. So that was like this great thing. My mother had these hard contacts, and they were always giving her a hassle, but she hated them. They were hard and they hurt. I got these soft ones. I would just put them on. I could hardly tell they were in. It was like, great. I can just see clearly. I've got contacts in. But I didn't realize it was making it even worse. Because when I took those off, I could hardly see anything. It got so ridiculous. You know, I had to have them in, or I had to wear glasses. And the glasses were pretty thick by this point. So that was what I was stuck with. And I went all the way through college, and I remember going to the eye doctor when I was a senior in college, and I could only read, on my good eye, I could read the lowest, the big E. I could read that. That was all I could read. And in my other eye, I couldn't even read that in my other eye. I don't know what the heck that is. They wrote down I could read fingers at 8 feet, or when I could count fingers at 8 feet or whatever. So that was the situation. And then when my brother and I decided to take this walk, you know, it was such a radical change, and I was questioning everything, and so I just put myself into the ultimate good situation. We were walking 20 miles a day, we were meditating probably 2 or 3 hours every day, we were getting so much fresh air and, you know, exercise and sunshine, we were living our purpose, I had these waves of joy just because I was doing what I wanted to do. We had no money. We didn't know what was going to happen every day. We were staying, you know, on the side of the road or in a church or in the woods or in a jail or who you didn't know where we're going to end up. But it was really a fantastic adventure. And so pretty early on, I'd say after about a month, I took my glasses off. I thought, I hate these damn things. And then my brother was kind of like my seeing eye dog, and he'd say, okay, look, be careful, you know, we got something up here or whatever. But what I found basically was, my vision started improving. You know, it just started getting better. But it still wasn't good. So I just kind of managed. I didn't have to drive. I was just walking, and I learned, and my other senses got better. My hearing and smell, everything else got more acute, and I managed, you know, and so that was it. So we walked, and we ended up going to the farm and all that, and then we ended up walking all the way to Alabama to the Zen Center. And then we were living there, and a lot of stuff happened. But then at one point, I had to, you know, I had to drive the car. They got a car there, and they said, you can go shopping. I was like, oh, my God. So I started driving this car. I thought, man, I'm dangerous. I can hardly see what the heck I'm doing. So I drove. I didn't drive very much. I maybe only drove once. It was just down, you know, down two blocks away and came back and made it. So my vision was still pretty bad. So what did I do? I think so what I did was I kept not wearing the glasses, and my vision improved quite a bit. And then at one point, I moved to Atlanta, and I was living in a meditation center in Atlanta. And there was a teacher there, this woman, and she said I should get some glasses. You know, really, I'm going to drive through. I got a job at a Holiday Inn, so I got some glasses, but they were better. They were not as strong, and I only wore them when I had to. So I was just wearing them when I was driving. I tried to just keep the glasses off as much as I could, and I started doing research. This was back before the internet. This was back in the 1970s, and I just started working on it, and then. It kept improving, but it still wasn't that good. And then at one point, I left Atlanta and I drove in my, I bought a little car. I drove all the way to San Francisco. And I was only wearing the glasses when I had to. And when I got there in, San Francisco, I was living in a Tibetan Buddhist meditation center. I mean, this miracles unfolded, and I could live in this Tibetan Buddhist meditation center. Even though they had like 20 people on the waiting list, they just let me in. It was like, how did that happen? I don't know, but they just let me in. And I was living with the Lama and meditating a lot. We would do these long retreats, 18 days. I went up into the woods of Oregon. I was meditating by myself for like 3 months in a cabin. All of that was really helping, I think. I was learning more and more that my mind and my body are not separate. I had this some revelations that the mind and the body really are not one. In fact, that I'm not my body. I remember at one point I left my body. I was looking down at my body walking along, and I could realize, I can see. See, I was up there. I was seeing perfectly, you know. I could see myself perfectly. I didn't need glasses. And I came back in my body. I still have this blur. But it wasn't, it was getting better. And one of the first things that happened when I got to San Francisco, I remember this guy. His name was Ji-Yun. And it was back in the days when there was no internet, but they had this, Open Education Exchange or some kind of magazine. And they had classes. And he had a class, called Throw Away Your Glasses. And I was like, wow, I want to go to that class. So I went to this class, and there was a bunch of people. There's probably 30 people sitting in a circle in this house in San Francisco. And he walked in, and people were wearing glasses, and he took out a pair of glasses. And he put it on the floor, and he had his shoe on, and he just crushed it with his heel. He smashed and destroyed the glasses, and he said, "That's what you need to do. You've got to destroy your glasses." We're all like, "Ah, help!" You know. And he just said, "You know, we are all brainwashed. This is all brainwashing. You don't need glasses. It's all your belief. It's all in your mind." He was doing all these crazy things. He said, "You don't need sunglasses. Nobody needs sunglasses." He said, if you need sunglasses, you think you're afraid of the sun. Why are you afraid of the sun? The sun, you know, open up. Open up your heart. Open up your mind. Open up to the light. You are the light. And he was a really, really far out guy, but he really got me thinking about a lot of things. Like, how much of this is just my mental conditioning and my belief? And so, so he didn't really have a lot of exercises to do, but he had just some certain things. And what he said actually was that if you really have to wear glasses, what you should do is go to an eye doctor and find an eye doctor who will give you a prescription that brings your eyesight to 20/40, not to 20/20, to 20/40, and then work and, you know, nutrition and breathing and so forth, and your eyes, and know the truth that you can see, you know, that kind of thing. And your eyes will get better naturally. And then when they get to 20/20, through the 20/40, then get rid of those glasses and get some weaker ones. And just keep getting weaker and weaker glasses and step it back gradually. So I started doing that. I got a pair of glasses that was weak, 2 weeks of, that I couldn't see to 20/20. And if I had to wear glasses, I would wear that. But I really rebelled. I didn't want to wear them. And then I started doing a bunch of other stuff. I got the pinhole glasses. I used to go, you know, the pinhole? They're these little pinhole. They're black. They have tiny pinholes. The pinhole glasses are really actually interesting. They do two things. When you look through these pinhole glasses, you can see clearly because it forces the light into a pinhole, and it goes straight back right into your retina, and it's clear. Because I was nearsighted. So, and they also sort of train the mind to see better. They kind of helps relax the muscle. So I started wearing those. And then, I'll just tell you a brief, I don't want to go on too long here, but it was quite an adventure. Then I took another class, a couple, and they taught a whole bunch of exercises that they had learned from this guy, an ex-military guy named Robert Hagman, who lived in South San Francisco. And they studied with him. And he was a really interesting character. They talked about how legendary he was and how he could stand like 20 feet from the wall and read a newspaper. You know, he had like eagle eyes. He had mastered vision. And he had gone to jail because he had taught people how to heal their vision and how to have perfect sight, but he wasn't an MD. And they threw him in jail. They threw him into jail because they said he was practicing medicine without him. He was healing people of their vision by teaching them these techniques, and he was thrown in jail. So I wanted to learn, like, what did he know? How did he do that? So I was studying with this couple, and they gave a whole series of exercises. So I was spending a half an hour every morning doing doubling exercises. I don't know if they're that good or not, but what you do is, it's called prefocal doubling and postfocal doubling. So I really mastered all this stuff. Like prefocal doubling, if you hold your finger, and prefocal doubling is when you focus in front of your finger, like if you hold it out in front of your finger, and then you get two fingers. That's prefocal doubling. So you learn to prefocal double. So you learn to to make it into two fingers that way. But then you learn postfocal doubling, which is harder if you're nearsighted. So you look past the finger and you make two fingers. And then the whole idea is then you do it with two. So then you do it with two fingers like this. So you get four fingers, prefocal and postfocal. And then you move them to the side more and more and more and more and more so that you can keep them doubled so you're expanding your vision. And then you do it, and then you make these wands. I was making these wands with reflective tape that you would put, that you do it with the lights out at night so that your eyes are in the dark. If they have to work even more, and you expand it as far as you can. Now, I was working so hard and spending so many hours on these vision exercises and then the other thing was I was working in San Francisco typing all day. I was typing. And so I learned this other whole technique, which I think is really good, which is, it was so funny though. I mean, when I think about what I did, I was working at Sohio Petroleum, a big oil company on the 18th floor of the Embarcadero Center in downtown San Francisco. And I was typing up oil leases for this company. I didn't work for them. I was an outside contractor. They wanted to hire me. I said, no, I'm not going to work for an oil company. I'm not going to do it. But I'll be an outside contractor, and you give me a lot of money. And they paid me. I was the highest paid word processor in the city of San Francisco, I'm sure. I had all of their leases, the entire Sohio Petroleum Company, the Standard Oil of Ohio. I had them all in my hands, every single lease, their entire company I had in my hands. I could have destroyed that company if I had just, in a way, it was so funny. But anyway, what I did was I read about this technique that if you put a piece of paper, like cardboard, exactly the right width, and you tape it to your forehead, and it's about this wide, like about three fingers wide approximately, but you got to measure exactly so that when you have a page, you're reading a page, so that one eye sees half the page and the other eye sees the other half of the page, so that your two eyes have to work independently, and you have about 1 inch in the middle that they can both see. So it's very precise, and you have to hold it exactly the right length. And when you do that, it's just great for your vision. It makes the eye, each eye has to work independently, but they also have to work with each other in the part in the middle. And so I would sit there for hours typing, and it was the funniest thing because I did it. I started wearing this thing on my forehead, you know, in the office, this thing taped on my forehead. It was the most ridiculous looking thing you can imagine. But there was two women that I oversaw that worked kind of under me, And I taught them about it, and they wore it too. So our whole department, when people walked in, they saw these three people with these things stuck to our foreheads. It was really hilarious. But they just thought, well, these are these wacky people back there. They take care of the leases. And we just told them, no, it's good for your vision. You know, we don't want to go blind doing this stupid work for you. So we're doing this, you know. And so that, I think, really helped, because I noticed as time went on, my vision kept getting better. Gradually, it kept getting better. And I had gone vegan. I went vegan in 1980. I was exercising a lot. I was running. I was doing pranayama. I was breathing. I was meditating probably 2 or 3 hours a day. And I think all these things are really helpful. So I remember the big day. I had a driver's license. My driver's license said I had to wear corrective lenses. And then I had to renew my license in Oakland. And I remember going in there, and I said, I'm going to see if I can pass this test, because you have to have 20/40 vision to pass the test. And I tried to do it on the wall, and I couldn't really quite make it. And the guy said, "All right, do it in the machine." So they had a machine there, so I did it in the machine. And lo and behold, through a variety of, I don't know, I think I squinted and I did this and that, but I passed the test. The guy said, "Okay, good, you're passed." I thought, oh my gosh, my driver's license said my vision was fine. It was such a great day. It was such a great moment. It's like, all right, you know, now at least I can drive without glasses. Great. And I was driving. I was driving without glasses anyway. I would only wear glasses when I was driving at night. I felt like I needed to. But my vision just kept gradually improving. And then I heard about a guy named Tom Quackenbush in San Francisco who gave vision improvement classes based on the Bates method. So I took I paid a lot of money for that class. It was kind of expensive. I mean, not a lot, but a few hundred dollars. And it was a series, and it was very methodical. And I did that whole class. And basically what he teaches, the Bates method, if you're familiar with it, is it's a series of, but it was the modified Bates method. So it's by a woman named Janet Goodrich, who had healed her vision, and her vision was really bad, and she got it right back to 20/20. And so it was based on the principle of SBB, sketch, breathe, blink. And those are the three most important things if you want to have healthy, clear vision. So sketch, breathe, blink means breathe and blink is pretty easy. Sketch is a little more complicated. But these are really important concepts if you want to have healthy vision. So I'll do the sketch later, but breathe basically means, well, the idea is this. When people develop a blur, it's because as little kids we contract. We're stressed, we're under tension, and we stare. We develop the habit of just locking our eyes onto something, just looking like watching TV and just boom, or just staring out the window and kind of like that. And it's very stressful for the visual system to stare, to kind of lock the eyes and kind of space out. But as children in our educational system, it really encourages kids to stare. And that's what leads to glasses. It leads to nearsightedness. Myopia. So breathing is really important, to just actually get conscious of your breathing and breathe a nice deep breath. The vision loves that, and it tends to release the cramping of the eye muscles around the eyes. So breathing, conscious breathing, and then blinking. That's the other thing. People who have a blur usually don't blink very much. So he said, pretend you have little butterfly blinks, make little butterfly blinks, and be conscious throughout the day that you're blinking. Blinking will naturally refresh the eye, it naturally encourages the eye to refocus, and it helps the little muscles to relax. So breathe, blink, and then sketch. What sketch means is you imagine that you have on your nose, you have a pencil or a feather or a pen, something, and whatever you're looking at, you're sketching it with your nose pencil, with your nose feather. You're touching it. So the whole idea is the neck. The neck gets locked in a cramp in most people who have a blur. It's like we kind of tighten up and we just, you know, we move our eyes, but we don't, like when we want to look at something, we just move our eyeballs. We don't move our whole head. So the whole idea is to just loosen the neck, loosen the head, and when you look at something, you just let your eyes in a gentle way caress whatever you're looking at, just gently caressing whatever you're looking at. People who naturally have good vision do that without trying. They just, They're kind of looking, they're moving around on a pinpoint. So it's a pinpoint. What you want to understand is the worst thing for having healthy vision is to spread out the vision, to try to see everything. What we want to do is just to see a little pinpoint, but move around. The fovea centralis, that pinpoint of the vision, it just sees a little thing. So you move it around and you can see, you can read signs or you can see nature, whatever it is, but you keep it moving easily. So you've got to release the neck. So sketching is the hardest part of it, to really learn to just release the neck and move the head around. Just tiny bit. He says, imagine you're just, sketching a Martian on Mars, right? You know, just far away, just a little bit. So this was a whole like 8-week class. I went in, every Wednesday night I studied. So it was a lot of information. I'm just grossly oversimplifying. The other thing he emphasized was yawning. Yawning is so fantastic. You know, the more we yawn, we live in a culture of don't yawn, it means you're bored, So, when you yawn, stretch, sketch, breathe, blink, yawn, all these things, anything you can do to kind of oxygenate yourself, move. We live in a society that just militates against healthy vision. We're kind of tight, we're kind of cramped, we're kind of eating foods that are toxic, we're not breathing, we're shallow breathing, all these things. So it's just a matter of like making an effort to learn proper vision habits. And then also understand that it's not so much the physicality of the eyeballs either. There's even, I remember this other guy, he wrote a book on vision. I mean, I've read a lot of books on vision. And this one guy, he was an eye doctor. He was an actual eye doctor. And he, and eye doctors can measure how your eyeball is. They have these very fine instruments. They can measure how much your eyeball is out of round. And so what he realized is that the eyeball can be out of round, so the person should have a blur, but they don't. They see perfectly fine. Or their eyeball can be round and they have a blur. And so it's very interesting. He said so much of vision is really mental. We really are kind of creating it in our mind, and it happened to him. He was able to measure his own eyeball was still not perfectly round, but he healed his vision. So there's many different levels of this. There's the physical level of the eyeball being out of round because of the muscles being cramped up, but there's also just the psychological dimension of vision. How much am I okay with seeing a sharp, clear world? Maybe the psychological, I feel more safe if things are kind of blurry. And we have to work with that level too. It's like, I feel a little better. I can't really see the harsh reality. I don't want to see that harsh reality out there. Give me a little protection. Then give me a blur. I feel a little safer. So I had to deal with those things. Like I was trying to block out the world. And to really say an affirmation every day, I embrace the world. I love to see the world clearly and sharply. I enjoy, I'm grateful from the vision. Really psychologically work with that. I also studied Christian Science. I remember when I was with my brother on that walk, we walked into this church where they were having faith healings. This was really an amazing experience, actually. This guy, these people, this was in West Virginia, West Virginia, they had a revival, and Ed and I had never seen anything like it. We walked in, and this was a little tiny town in the hills of West Virginia, and this guy came in from out of town, and he was a master at getting people up on their feet and praising the Lord, and the emotional, and I would say also spiritual energy kept going higher and higher and higher, until it became almost like a complete, like, you don't know what's going to happen next. People were marching around and singing and shouting. And then some people started throwing themselves on the ground and then moving around. And then they got up and they started speaking in these other languages. Just speaking like, just talking, I don't know what they were saying. But they were, and then at one point the minister, and we were kind of sticking out because we were these two young hippies that had come from, they didn't know where, and we were there. And they were looking at us like, who are these guys? And I remember at the end, the minister was calling people up for healing. And it was really pretty spectacular. He had about two or three people came up that had, you know, a limp or something, and he laid his hand on them, and he had his other hand up, and he says, through the power of Jesus, you know, and he was really, man, he was like just so intense that everybody was focusing, you know, be healed. And he was just, you are whole, you are healed by the power of Jesus, the power of God, you know. And at one point, I just thought, I'm going to go up and have him heal me. And I did. I walked up. And he was like, oh man, look at this. You know, the whole place got really quiet all of a sudden. And he said, what is it? And I said, my vision. He said, all right. You know, and he put his hands here, you know, and I closed my eyes, and he just gave this, all this energy, and the whole place was just like, you know, your vision is perfect. You are healed, you know, and the whole place. And I remember I opened my eyes. And I really expected I would see totally clearly. I was like a believer at that point. I saw all these healings. They were happening. You know, people were, that hadn't walked, they were walking. I mean, this really was working. It was pretty intense. I opened my eyes and it was still a blur. But I'll never forget his face. It was really so full of light and love. It was really full of love. I have to say, he had so much love pouring out of him. And I said, he said, is it clear? And I said, it's better, but it's still a blur. And he said, you will see. You will. And he was right. You know, it took like probably 15 or 20 years, but you know, but finally I got to the point where I got to, I'm pretty much at 2020 now. So, I love it. I mean, I just think, you know, this was something I was, and the funny thing was I went back, years later, I was in Maine, and I remember going back to the same office where I had my, and the same office, you know, where I had my vision tested, because I didn't remember, and I said, do you have any records for William Tuttle, you know, from back in 1974, whenever it was, this was probably in the, I don't know when it was, in the 90s, and they looked back through the old, this was before computers, you know, they still had the paper, oh yeah, I got, yeah, right here. Are you him? I said, oh yeah, I'm him. He said, yeah, you had, and that's when they told me you could only, you know, see the E, the one letter, and you had to count fingers, and then I remember, so she said, so you were in contacts now, I guess, right? And I said, no, actually, I'm not wearing contacts. And she looked at me like, and she said, well, you had an operation done, right? I said, no, actually, I healed my vision. And she looked at me like, she just turned away. Walked away. She was like, she did not want to hear anything about it. She had no curiosity. She was like, just get out of here. You know, she, it was like totally threatening to her. And I just realized, you can't talk about this. I mean, their whole world will collapse. The idea that what they're doing is completely unnecessary. I mean, you know, but anyway, that's my story. And, I think, you know, it's really, it's kind of a reflection of the fact that there is a lot more that we can do to help ourselves. I'm not saying everybody can do that. I mean, you know, we're all unique and we all in our own ways. But I think there are more things that we can heal through our consciousness than we realize. If we don't try, it'll never happen. If we just believe the medical establishment, it'll probably be right. I mean, there may be things, though, that medicine is better. You know, so, if, you know, I'm not saying you should never, but I'm just saying, very often we pay a price, you know, too. So it's an interesting phenomenon, and I think it reflects, the material reflects the spiritual. And if we focus, the more we focus on the spiritual, the more the material will follow suit. We may still need to use some material, but I think the more, you know, ultimately we can get to the point where we don't have to. And that happens to people, you know, there's all kinds of so-called unexplained healings happen, and they can't explain it, but that's very often. We see it here at Hippocrates also. People heal, and it's great. So thanks, Susan, for the question, and I hope I kind of rattled on a long time, but I think, when I think back on that, I'm so grateful that that was my, like my, in Zen they call it a koan. A koan is a question that just takes hold of your mind, and you want to like, what? I want to solve this dang thing. I wanted to understand vision. You know, why can't I see? You know, what's going on here? And a koan, the neat thing about a koan, whatever, we all have koans, right? We all have things we want to understand. How can I have a loving relationship? Or how can I have abundance in my life, or how, what am I, or what, you know, whatever it is. And those questions, the good thing about it is the question can be a success. Not that you answer it, but that it brings you to a point where you get to a transcendence. You transcend the prison. That's, it's really designed, you know, koans, these deep questions are designed, I think, we gravitate toward them because there's a gift there, but it's uncomfortable to deal with it. It's uncomfortable, but it's like anything, you know, it's the discomfort keeps us going because, you know, we don't want to give up until we somehow have a resolution. And I think that's so important because addiction comes from escaping, right? I can just have a drink or I can just eat something, you know, and it just pushes down the discomfort, which is the worst possible thing. You need the discomfort. Discomfort is propelling, it propels us to a higher state. And so, but the pharmaceutical industry, the medical industry, they provide a lot of things to just relieve the discomfort, go back to sleep. That's the worst thing. Then the discomfort has to hit harder and come up on the 2x4, as they say, you know, and really whack us. So, the more sensitive we get, you know, there's an old saying in the Buddhist tradition that for the average person, this world, is like a hair rubbing against the palm. It's like, it's not that uncomfortable. For someone who's on a spiritual path, this world is like a hair rubbing against your eyeball. You know, the idea is that we become very sensitive to the suffering in our own life and the suffering of others, and we really, that motivates us to want to understand and do something to improve our lives and help other people. And so, in a way, we shouldn't feel bad that we're sensitive. Sensitivity is good in a certain sense. It's a cross to bear, but it's better than the alternative, which is to be numb. And then we're lost, really, for a while. I mean, we're never lost completely. We have another lifetime, but you know, for this lifetime, we need to, I think, cultivate the sensitivity also to these things. All right, so thank you. You're welcome. Let's see, Elizabeth. Yes, you have a question? Let's see here.
Well, Dr. Tuttle, do you recognize me?
Oh, Haransky Beck. it's a small. I have to change the view. Maybe I can see better. But my tell me. Give me a hint.
I'm going to leave it a little bit of a mystery, but all I'm going to say is that I just want everybody here to know that what you just offered is worth its weight in gold. And I have some credentials behind what I'm saying, and I'm just going to leave it a mystery at the very end of this time. If you don't remember anything about my name or my credentials, then I'll let on at the end. But I just want everybody to know that what you just spoke is truth. And it's really important to understand that we have the potential to rise into who we're meant to be. And what we're told through medicine and through culture is a smokescreen. And I guess the question that came up for me is, so I came into veganism through, from the health angle.
Uh-huh.
And so, but I became, you know, much more understanding about the animals over time for obvious reasons. But I still feel a deep thread of anger, when I hear people that live the vegan lifestyle related to animals, but not necessarily, they're not necessarily taking care of themselves. And so there's kind of what I see, this is as an outsider, because I've never been an animal activist in the way that some are. I've been an activist for a lot of other things and continue to be, but that's not my role in this physical form. So my question, my koan that you mentioned tonight is, my question is, what is that within me? So I'm turning it back into myself. But what I definitely notice is there's a chasm in the vegan world, a separation between this thing called an animal, a domesticated animal, and this thing called a human being. And so we're cherishing, some of us, the animals that are not human first before we're cherishing ourselves. So that's just kind of what came through. So I'll leave it at that, and I'll leave a little bit of mystery.
All right. Thank you so much. And so to address your question, I think it is a problem in the vegan movement. And I'm not sure, you know, everybody is unique. So a lot of people come to so-called veganism or whole food plant-based diet, some people call it, or plant-based diet or plant-sourced diet if it's like really totally plant-sourced, for their own health, and they care about their health. And they really don't care that much about animals. And so they do get healthier. And the good news with that approach, I think, is that very often once they stop eating animal foods, they begin gradually through various, maybe talking to people or whatever, to think about, they're more open to the suffering of the animals, and then their motivation can deepen. That's what I'm hoping. That's one of the reasons I wrote the World Peace Diet, was to try to help people who we're only vegan because they're raw food. A lot of raw food is like that. They're into raw food and they don't care that much about animals. But at some point, they maybe broaden or deepen their motivation, and they really start doing it for the animals. And then they don't cheat, because when we're doing it just for ourselves, it's pretty easy to cheat and eat some dairy, some eggs, some fish, whatever. But I've also seen quite a few over the years, and I'm sure you all have too, people who don't care that much about themselves, they're really upset about animals. They really want to try to help animals, or they can't stand suffering to animals. And they often just eat crappy food, you know, quite often. So they don't take care of themselves really very well, and drive themselves, and very often they can be, anyway, it seems like judgmental of other people, other vegans, and so forth, and very often don't engage in a lot of inner work either, but they care about animals. But I've seen them also start to learn that that's not a good idea. That's another reason I wrote the World Peace Diet, was to help those kind of vegans to really take better care of their health, and not just eat vegan junk food, but really eat whole organic foods. Because if they're not healthy, and that's the weird thing, I've seen it happen. People who are only into veganism for their health, only into veganism for the animals, but then their health deteriorates because they're stressed out, they're not meditating, they're eating vegan junk food, they're in a lot of toxic relationships very often, or angry, and they're just wired up, and they hate humans. And the funny thing is, they start eating meat again. And I would think they would never do that, but they actually do. They actually go back to eating meat, or at least dairy, or something. And I think that's so strange. But then because they would never do it, but they just, at a certain point, if you really don't feel healthy. And sometimes they even blame it on veganism, which is terrible for the movement. So I really think it's important for vegan activists to absolutely love animals and care about them and help promote a compassionate way of living for the animals. But to really take care of ourselves and to love ourselves and to eat healthy food for this being. And make that a priority, because if we're not healthy, we're a burden on others. Plus, people are going to look at us and they say, "Well, you don't look very good." And I'm not going to do it. You know, if you're kind of going around being miserable and unhappy and sick, they'll say, "Well, I'm glad I'm not a vegan. If I'm going to look like you, or if I'm going to act like you, or if I'm going to be angry and judgmental and criticizing and blaming
you." I'm going to interrupt you now because I can't resist. Because I'm about to burst open. Because I don't believe there's any mistakes. I was invited graciously to come here tonight by Lisa Wong.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I remember that from another time. Yeah, Lisa.
Yeah, just come here. And so, Dr. Tuttle, I want to thank you, and I want to thank Judy Carman, and I want to thank Lisa Wong, because today I signed off on, it's a book. It's called Enlivening Consciousness, Deepening Your Journey Through Vision, Movement, Nutrition, Nature, and Spirit.
Wow.
And I want to thank you and Judy because you both wrote praise for us. I sent you my manuscript months and months ago.
Oh, right.
So long ago, and you're so busy.
And yeah.
You're so busy keeping your vision good and doing so much good in the world. You don't even know who I am.
No, I know you're very familiar.
I think are smiling in the background. And the reason I wrote the book is because it's all about the intersectionality of health and wellness and the animals and the environment and spirit and vision. I'm an eye doctor. I'm one of those eye doctors. I'm an optometrist. I've specialized in natural eyesight improvement for my whole career.
Wow.
And so I know you read at least part of my book.
Yes. Yeah, I remember that now. Yeah, it's great.
I don't remember what you wrote, but I've got a proof right here. But literally today, I'm celebrating because I've never written a book before, but this one's going to be coming out within the next month. And so I invite everybody who learned anything from what Dr. Will Tuttle just said, I want you to know you just had the best course on the planet. And this eye doctor took 6 pages of notes because I was doing this so that you couldn't see me writing down. Because the techniques that you gave have names in my world. One is called a binasal occluder. The other is called physiological diplopia, when you're making things double. But the point is that what you put across is it takes work. And life to reach your potential is not just, you can't anesthetize yourself. In any of the different areas that I wrote about and that you've written about and that Judy's written about and that the rest of you will write about, because if you haven't written your book yet, get your outline going. Because I know you have very special people here. But I was just, Lisa invited me and then who asked the question?
Susan Daytree, yeah.
Susan asked this question. I'm like, this is going to be interesting. Bill told me he had some kind of background with this, but you didn't really go into it. You just wrote something for my book. It was easy for you to do, so you didn't even remember. But thank you, Susan, too, and thank you, everybody. But, yeah, it was really, really a succinct course that you gave tonight. And so it may seem, these things seem crazy. I've worked with people for my entire career in natural eyesight improvement. And I've, been advocating for people and children on the ADD to autism spectrum and post-traumatic brain injury. And, your case in the scheme of things is relatively simple based on who I was working with over the course of my career. But it's possible on every level as long as you're committed, right?
Wow.
You have to want to do it. And a lot of us have been a little bit numbed out, especially recently, right? And so it's like, get that. That's one way. But we don't have to go that way. We can go the other way, and it's fun.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it is fun. It's work, but it's like anything. You've heard me talk about this before, but I was raised with this idea of practicing and how important it is to practice. Now, can you turn that off for this morning? And I think, it's all about practice, really. Just practice and whatever we put our attention on is going to expand and improve. So thank you. Thanks so much, Elizabeth. And I remember you now. Yeah, I remember that manuscript. And I remember Lisa inviting you. And you had an appearance on our call at one point. And that's so wonderful. I think you live up north, like in Pennsylvania or something, if I remember.
Southwestern PA, outside of Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh, yeah. Right.
When are you coming here?
That's a good question. We usually are doing our tour in the winter, and I already pushed my luck too far with going to Ohio. Madeline was like, that's too far north in November. It was too cold. So we'll see. Maybe we can make it out there in earlier, because we would like to get across the northern part of the country. It's just we've got this garden in California, and we don't want to leave before the persimmon harvest. So I'll keep you posted. But thank you so much. It's great to have you with us, and I'm so glad. This is so synchronistic. It's fantastic. I have a couple other hands up. Tammy, you had your hand up for quite a while. Good to see you all the way from, are you in the far north in Canada up there? And
in Calgary with my
Calgary,
partner.
Right. Oh, hi.
My vegan love I found a couple of years ago.
Beautiful. Thank you. Great. Welcome.
Yeah. I just want to make a comment about it. It really made me laugh out loud when you're talking about, you know, before you knew it, you had everyone in the office with paper taped across their forehead. And and I was just really smiling at how, you know, your deep authenticity and genuine spiritual connection just has had people believing in you, you know, for a very long time. So that just made me really smile. And the other thing, you know, I was thinking about when we were talking about vision and moving our eyes and moving our head and doing different movements. And I was thinking about being in school, and I was raised in the bush in Northern Ontario. And I remember if they would have, you know, been drugging kids as much as they are now 55 years ago, I would have been drugged for sure, because that's what they do to our children, right? Like 50% are drugged by the time they're 18.
Right.
I would guess more now, but pretty high numbers. But I was thinking about how I had such a hard time sitting in my desk, and how it was trained into us to not move. And I wonder if we weren't trained, whether we would just move a lot naturally. Like, we learned even to sit still in front of a screen. And I don't know. I don't know what kind of life we would have had. I don't know. I just think about that sometimes.
Right. Well, that's the thing. You know, the way our modern lifestyle in many ways is totally contrary to how we would hold our bodies and how we would move through the day and how we did for millions of, or however long, thousands or millions of years. So it puts a lot of stress on this body, and I think it's good to be aware of that and try to, as much as possible, counteract it and try to connect more with nature, connect more with how our body would like to be in the world. And if we don't, we see the results. I remember watching, it was way back in the, before computers, back in the 90s, a little short documentary about vision that had to do with the Eskimos, people living up in Alaska. And it was the dangest thing. You know, these Eskimo people, they had good, great vision. They were out there living. And this documentary showed how they went up there and they built a schoolhouse, and they taught all the Eskimo kids to sit at a desk and read. And every single one of those Eskimo kids had glasses on. Every single one of them. Not one didn't have glasses on. And I was thinking, gosh, you know, they would never be wearing glasses. But they put them in that box and doing that. And then they, you know, the eye doctor, you know, made his money on the whole thing. But, of course, and then they're feeding and they're eating, burgers and junk food and, you know, everything's getting shipped up there. And I mean, their whole way of life changed completely. And so I think a lot of these things are sort of the so-called diseases of civilization, right? They just sort of happen because we're out of touch with our natural capacities. And the good thing is, I think we can become aware of that and do our best to return again to that as best we can and then share these ideas with other people. Ultimately, we're not these bodies. I mean, that's the important thing to remember. Ultimately, we're not this physical body. We are the eternal consciousness that makes this possible. And that awareness itself, I think, can help us to overcome a lot of the resistance. Just knowing that the quality of consciousness is to see, right? Or is to be aware, is to know directly. That is who we are. We have that capacity. And we seem to be using a physical vehicle, but like at night when we're dreaming, we see all kinds of things, all kinds of bright colors. You know, we can be colorblind maybe during the day, but we're not at night during our vision. At least I'm not. I see all kinds of colors. So I think the more we can understand that we have a lot more powers and capacities than our society admits, then we can heal a lot more of the so-called problems that we're having. And then maybe we can also leave a lot of these things out of our lives. Just not do it, not use them. I never wear sunglasses, for example. I don't know. I mean, if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I just Jiyun made it so clear to me that one day when he did it, I thought, all right, that's it. I'm done. I'm never wearing sunglasses.
That's a good thing.
I never have.
It's a good thing. You're not supposed to look into the sun, but you're
right.
Supposed to have sun come into your body without windows in front of your eyes. And
right,
that's
yeah.
not what we're taught in school. It's the opposite of what we're taught.
Yeah,
and you're supposed to wake up with the sunrise and go to sleep with the sunset.
Right.
And you're supposed to be in the light for 4 hours a day, according to Henry David Thoreau, his essay Nature, you know, and so that's normal, but what we've normalized is the opposite of that, right? And
yeah.
that's why we're the slaves, and it's not just the animals. It's us.
Yeah, you're right. That's exactly it. I mean, that's my new book, Food for Freedom. I go into those ideas, and I really appreciate you sharing it very clearly. Yeah, good old Thoreau. Yeah, and sunlight. Sunlight is told, we're told that sunlight is the enemy. We have to protect ourselves. We have to wear sunscreen. We put on these toxic, incredibly toxic chemicals that go right into our, you know, putting something on your skin, it's pretty much like eating it. It goes right into your bloodstream. And you see what's in these sunscreens is really terrible. When you can actually let your skin get used to the sun and sun, vitamin D and sun, I think sun is information. It's our friend. It's a great ally. And all these things, water, nature, all these are our good friends, and we're taught to be afraid of them. And so thank you for confirming that, Elisa. And I think I'm glad I'm not wearing sunglasses. Good. All right. Let's see. Suzanne, you have your – I don't know. We have only about 10 minutes, but that's okay. Let's jump
yeah,
in.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Will. My question that what do you say to people who say they feel better when they eat animal products or drink animal products, and they try being vegan and they, you know, they try it, but then when they have that piece of salmon, wow, they feel just happier and more energized and they can think better. And they've tried it. They've tried this and they've tried that and they just feel better. Do you think there are people that just really truly feel better with animal products and like actually sort of need them? Because that would totally not go along with a totally vegan world, obviously. So what do you say to people when they say to you they feel better with animal products?
Yeah, that's more than a 10-minute talk, but I think it's a great question. It's one of the big problems that we're facing. And to answer it sort of briefly, I think, Michael Clapper gets into this because he, as an MD, he sees all these people coming to him and he tells them to go on a vegan diet. And he says that sometimes people seem like they don't do that well on a vegan diet. And so he has to kind of do it somewhat gradually with them. And the reasoning is that even though our natural physiology is keyed in directly to eating a vegan diet, an organic whole plant-based diet is ideal for any human being. I mean, that's what we all have the same basic physiology. And the thing is, people are born into a culture for the first, you know, maybe they never even get mother's milk, they get cow's milk right off the bat, you know, some kind of cow's milk. Then they're getting chicken and fish and beef and turkey and cheese and all this stuff when they're only, you know, 1 or 2, 3 years old as they grow up. So their whole physiology has to radically shift, right, to something else. And so and then if they want to go vegan, say they see a video or whatever, they think, oh man, now I'm going to go vegan. They try it. It's like their body really rebels because they become kind of addicted to it physiologically. And there is physiological addiction, with the case of morphines and other substances in animal foods. But it's like like any toxic substance is addictive, right? Alcohol, tobacco, there's lots of things that your body would rather not have it, but if it makes the adjustment for it, then it's like, all right, now don't take it away. I figured it out, don't take it away. And so it'll crave it, for various reasons. There's actually addictive substances in these foods. So that's part of it. Another part of it is, that when, people are kids growing up, they don't remember the subconscious memories of psychological addiction, right? I mean, coming home, from whatever, from practice, and then as a kid, and then mom has made a nice aromatic beef stew or whatever, and we just feel loved. She cares about us. She knows we like that. We do not want to give that up subconsciously. We feel better or whatever it is. And so, our mind, the placebo effect is enormously powerful. We can feel something's going to make us feel better, and it will. And a lot of vegans, I write about this in the World Peace Diet, if they go vegan for the animals, and then if they don't feel that healthy for some reason, and the doctor maybe says, you should really eat some chicken, or you should eat some fish, and the immediate reaction is, no, I'm not going to do that. I love chickens, I love fish, I'm not going to do it. But then, if they persist and they think, oh, maybe I should, I really don't have a lot of energy, okay. And so it's an incredibly powerful placebo because the more repulsive something is, the more powerful of a placebo it will be. And this is well understood. If you make a medicine really cheap, then it doesn't work very well. You make it really expensive, so people have to God, I can't even afford it, but God, it must work. And it works a lot better. The placebo effect is like more powerful than any medication. So when they have an ethical kind of side to it and they don't really want to do it, but they feel like they have to because they're special, it's a very powerful placebo. So then they'll reward themselves subconsciously. I just felt so great when I had that chicken, when I had that fish. It's because they have to do that. But that's not conscious. It's just at a fundamental level. And then it also, being a vegan in our world is inconvenient. It's enormously inconvenient. It's challenging. And even animal rights activists, but especially people who are not animal rights activists, they would that's a get out of jail free card, right? If you say, I tried being a vegan, it didn't work. Case closed. You tried it, didn't work. So now for the rest of your life, you are home free. You can go to McDonald's with a clear conscience. You can eat whatever you want with a clear conscience because you tried it, didn't work for you. You must be type such and such blood type, or you must be this or that or the other. And it's so, and when 98% of the people are not vegan, it sure is a lot nicer to be in that 98% than to be in that 2% that everybody hates because they're not eating the tribal food that everybody is suspicious of because we're not eating the tribal food. So to be in the tribe, at the deepest level, that's the most important thing. Nothing more important to a human being than fitting in, getting along, and being liked. I mean, that's more important than anything. So there's so many levels to this. This question is like, you can't just answer the question because you got to know the person. And first of all, when they say they feel better when they eat meat, what are they eating when they're not eating, when they're being a vegan? Like, what are they actually eating? And they don't even know what they're eating. They have to do a food journal and write it all down every single day, what they're eating. And is it organic? Is it whole? Is it healthy? Is it like, what is it? So, but the thing is, if, what is your relationship with them? If you're in a relationship with them, do they trust you? Can you just say something and they'll say, okay, and try it? Or are they kind of suspicious of you, or they think they know better than you anyway? So you're not going to get anywhere if they think that, they know better than you. So the thing is, if I come off like I know more than they do about themselves, which maybe I do, maybe, we've studied nutrition a lot more than they have, and they're just, going along with the program of the society, it's easier to eat what everybody else is eating. If I try to change someone who doesn't want to be changed, they'll just fight back. You know, you can't, so the best thing is to just try, like I've been said many times, to plant seeds, by just talking about myself. I can say just, you know, I'm so glad that I realized I was just following orders and I feel great. And if you want to know more about what I actually eat, I'm happy to tell you. But as soon as they feel like you're trying to change them, probably they're going to resist, because if someone was trying to change me, I would resist, right? I mean, that's natural. If they feel like you're trying to manipulate them or change them to be like you. So it's a very tricky thing. That's why it's so difficult to share the vegan message, because the vast majority don't, and food is our most intimate connection with our relationships and with nature. And we can easily psychologically condition ourselves to need to eat meat. You know, I could make myself, if I didn't want to go to school, I could, you know, but I didn't want to lie. I'd say, oh, I don't feel well. And, you know, within a few hours, I really didn't feel well. So I wasn't lying. And my mother would say, yeah, he can't go to school. He doesn't feel well. You know, our mind will create the condition. And if people subconsciously want to make themselves feel terrible if they're not eating meat, they'll do it. And they'll feel great when they eat meat. And so there has to be something born in them where they actually realize that they're killing. It's unnecessary. And there's nothing more powerful than healthy vegans who are confident, who are not trying to change people, but who are just planting seeds and saying how wonderful it is to be free of the cultural program. Because no one wants to be a slave to a cultural program, especially if it's harming the earth and harming their own health. And it is. I mean, toxins concentrate in these foods. They are harming themselves physically, and they're harming animals for sure. They know that. These animals are being killed. And it's unnecessary. And you're a wonderful example of someone who's thriving, who's not killing animals. There's no nutrients in animals that didn't come from plants. So there isn't any outer reason. It's just, they're in the driver's seat because most people are like them. And, you know, you could say things like, you know, like 150 years ago, people in the South owned slaves. And when people in the North said, or other people who didn't have slaves said, you know, you can farm without slaves. No, I can't do it. I can't do it. No, no, no. I can never do it. I have to have, we have to have slaves. That's how we have to do it. We always did it. We have to do it with slaves. Well, they didn't have to do it with slaves. You know, that was just a lot easier. And now they don't do it with slaves. And it's okay. You know, you hire people, you figure it out, right? So that's the same thing. It's like, but when everybody owns slaves, and that's what everybody does, and that's what everybody does, but it's unethical, like it's immoral. It's, you're owning another being, you're causing, you're like owning them. That is unethical. You can't own another being. You can kill him if you want to, because he's just your property. You can rape her, you can do whatever you want, because he's just your property. We look back and we go, that's horrible. You can't, you know, that's terrible. But the reason they did it was healthy. It was healthy. It was economically healthy. They liked it. It was worked great. Worked great for me. Oh, I can get a lot of work done. It's fantastic. So it's just self-centered motivation. That's all. So, you can maybe point things out in a loving way. Like, you know, do you really want to live your precious life causing misery and violence to other beings? But don't say it that way. Say more like, I'm so glad that in my precious life, I'm not causing misery and suffering to other beings. This body is the temple of the spirit, and I'm so glad that I'm building this temple with bricks of joy and freedom, you know, try not to like blame them or criticize, because they'll just fight back. Just be honestly happy about it. And it's really not so much what we say. We always go, what do I say? It's really not what we say. It's like who we are. And just without trying to change people, try to live this sense of joy and freedom and health fully, and people will just be drawn to it. And maybe you never change certain people, so let it go. But there's other people who will be more open to the message. Because we tend to find, you know, certain people are our friends or our neighbors or our family, we want to get them. And maybe they're the hardest ones in the whole universe to actually ever change. But there's millions of other people all around you that maybe are really interested and would be happy with what you have to say. So it's important, I think, to just lighten up and just plant positive seeds based on our own experience and telling our own story. And understanding the power of the mind and sharing these ideas with love to other people without trying to change them That's really the thing. But it's a lot to understand, really, psychologically. But the good news is you're on totally solid ground. There are no people that have to eat animal foods to be healthy. They maybe need to, like Michael Clapper said, go through a little, like, weaning off of these toxic products till they're used to it. Oh, and the other thing, just to say quickly, is that when people go to a healthy diet, they start cleansing. They start cleaning out. So all these heavy metals, PCBs, dioxin, all the pesticide, herbicide, fungicide residues, they've all stashed it away in the fat cells of their body. They start eating a healthier diet. Their body starts releasing those things, and they get a cough. They're always coughing. Or they just feel so weak because their body is cleansing. Or they don't have energy because their body's cleansing. Or they get a rash. Or they have diarrhea. I mean, these are all symptoms of cleansing. And they go to the doctor, and the doctor says, oh yeah, you're sick. What are you doing? Well, I'm trying a plant-based diet. Oh, no wonder. Oh yeah, you shouldn't do that. No, you better eat some meat. They eat some meat, they stop the cleanse, they feel great. Yeah, but all the toxins are still there. So it's all, the system is all set up to make people sick and have them eat animal foods and never question anything. And the doctors are the worst enemy to the animals and the pharmaceutical industry because they're all programmed to support the whole thing and tell everybody they should eat animal foods. So it's not an easy thing, you know, but we have to understand it and try to raise our own vibrational level to a high enough up so that we reach the best in other people to make them want to go to a higher level and let go of the violence and misery to be more happy and free and healthy. I think that's ultimately what's going to make this thing snowball more and more, is people just going to a higher level and realizing this is all old satanic baloney and we don't have to have any part of it anymore. And they can say whatever they want. They can be promoting slavery and sexual abuse and killing, but they're eating it and they're causing it, and that's inescapable. No matter what they say, well, it's got this nutrient and that nutrient. Yeah, but look, you eat, it's violence and it's unnecessary. Look at me. Here I am. I'm not any different than you. We're not different. They always want to emphasize how we're all so different. What? I mean, the elephants and all these other animals aren't going around like eating all different food. I mean, we have the same basic physiology. But to say it in a way, I discovered that we all have the same basic physiology. You know, it's like, really, this maybe, you know, we might have a different bacteria in our microbiome, so that has to adjust, right? So it'll take a while for us to be able to digest these foods because we have a community of bacteria that's developed over our whole lifetime to digest the foods we're eating. So we change our diet. We need to. I mean, that's going to take a while to change over, but when it does, we'll finally be, you know, get over the constipation that all meat eaters are constipated. They know it, and start really being healthy and happy. I've gone over.
So. Thank you, Will. Thank you. That's really, really helpful. It's complicated.
And I think the other thing is the whole Weston A. Price thing is very, very convincing to a lot of people. And they listen to that, and they're like, oh, yeah,
Oh, yeah. No, you're right. It's very convincing. And I just sent out those two videos. Did you see those two videos I sent out? I sent it out on our mailing list, but yeah, go to our YouTube station, the YouTube channel, Will Tuttle, and just look at that. They're only 5 minutes each, and I'm just addressing some of these things that Weston A. Price Foundation is saying. All right, we have to stop. So let's all gather together and say our prayer. Madeline's right here. We can unmute your phones and your computers. I'm sorry, we just went, the whole thing went so fast. I didn't even get a chance to read anything. Pardon me?
We're 5 minutes over time, right?
We're 5 minutes over, which I don't like to do. So let's say our prayer together. Madeline, come on.
Yes.
We're all waiting. You're busy.
Yeah.
Really, yeah.
Well, we have to say we're sorry to Kenny because he had his hand up in the very beginning at the same time I did, but I got in the...
Yeah, Kenny.
I was going to ask you about Christspiracy, but the next time.
Christspiracy is on the way, March 20th. March 20th. It's going to show in 700 theaters.
Wow.
Over United States. So figure it out and try to help Chip and Cam promote it.
Are you in the movie, Will?
Yeah, I'm in it.
Quick question. You're in it. Okay, good. That's good.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to be next month. We'll be the third Thursday in March. I'm not sure where we'll be, but we'll see you then. And the first Thursday in March, we'll see you then. All right, so let's say our prayer together. Here we go. Compassion encircles the earth for all beings everywhere. Again. Compassion encircles the earth for all beings everywhere.
Everywhere.
One more time with a lot of feeling. Compassion encircles the earth for all beings everywhere. And so it is.
Yay.
All right, much love to all of you.
Bye.
See you next time. Read the resources. I got lots of information on the resources. All righty.
Thank you.
Love you.
Thank you so much, everybody.
All right.
Thank you, Lisa.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you, Will.
Bye, everyone. Shalom.
We